Current State here on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. We're glad you're along here for Thursday. Coming up this hour, we are moving closer, I guess, to development in downtown East Lansing. Moving slightly closer, okay? A plan is starting to emerge. Yesterday, a panel from East Lansing of citizens and city employees and other interested people finally made nominations, or made recommendations, I should say, for developers to take over the Park District with their plans, or not so much to take over, but to have their plans considered more closely above all the others by the East Lansing City Council. We'll talk with Lori Mullins of the City of East Lansing coming up later this hour. Also, MSU artist Carl Goode has a new exhibit. He's a painter, and we will learn more about that from Current State's Peter Wharf. We also got input from a listener yesterday we want to pass along in an attempt to set the record straight. Yesterday, Lansing Mayor Virge Bernero and I discussed for a bit transportation around the Lansing area, and specifically bus service for a minute. The mayor claimed at one point that Indian Trails Bus Company is an out-of-state bus company. And we found out from a listener who wrote, I listened to part of your interview with the Lansing mayor this morning. I would hope you correct, if possible, his statement that Indian Trails is an out-of-state bus company. Indian Trails was founded in Owosso, Michigan in 1910, and its headquarters is still here. It has two other bases of operation, but they are both in Michigan, in Kalamazoo and Romulus. So hopefully that sets the record straight. Captain Mike Yankowski is about a month into his new responsibilities as interim chief of the Lansing Police Department. Yankowski succeeded Chief Teresa Szymanski, who retired. Here's our next guest back on April 18th, the day he was named to his new position.
Excellence, character, respect, teamwork, compassion, and courage will define the Lansing Police Department. But we cannot keep this community safe without working with, for, and this community. Community engagement is paramount to policing. We will continue to work closely with our neighborhoods, businesses, and schools to build those strong partnerships to keep this city safe.
And Interim Chief Michael Yankowski joins us now on Current State. Welcome. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you. Thank you, Mark, for having me.
What's been the biggest adjustment for you since taking the chief's position?
Well, you know, it's certainly been an honor. I'm very humbled and honored that Mayor Bernero had the confidence to put me in this position to lead one of the finest organizations in the country. The biggest challenge, I think, that we have found for me is the volume is very high. And I was very used to a high volume as a patrol division captain, but it's just a little bit different level. It's taken up to another notch.
Volume meaning what?
You know, the level of contacts, internal, external, community, the government side of the house, is that my ties to those individuals are a lot closer now. Mm-hmm. And I'm the final say-caper there, and there's no buffer there. So it's now me making those decisions rather than me going to the police chief.
Sure.
And saying, hey, this is my recommendation, or here's an issue that we got to deal with.
Is it lonely at the top?
I wouldn't say it's lonely yet. You know, I know that as you keep going up higher in the ranks at times, that comment's made a lot of times. But, you know, we have so many tremendous, wonderful people that work for the Lansing Police Department, and I'm very blessed to have those underneath me.
You oversee how many people then as chief?
Right now we have about 195 sworn officers and an additional almost 40 civilians.
Okay. Very recently, there were a string of sexual assaults here in East Lansing on Michigan State's campus. The suspect apparently is still at large. Now, we realize this is not your jurisdiction, but it is so close. Does the Lansing Police Department get involved in these kinds of neighboring investigations? And if so, how exactly?
Well, we do work very closely with our law enforcement partners. Every week we hold what we call detective briefing meetings, a regional detective meeting that all players from all the agencies come together and we share information, we share crime trends, we share analysis of what we have going on in our jurisdictions and how can we help each other solve those crimes. So we've been already doing that on a weekly basis, but we're looking to expand that even further.
More than once a week?
Well, I think that one of the philosophies that I've really brought to the Lansing Police Department is really looking at a data-driven approach. And in doing that, using it more timely and accurate, we want to get on top of these issues as quickly as possible. And so if there is an issue in the city or in a surrounding jurisdiction, we want to get together in a more timely manner to put the resources together that we can help solve those issues more quicker.
Would that include more departments, more outlying departments than you've included in the past? Is that part of what you're saying?
Well, we've always worked very closely with the federal government, the state government, and local municipalities. And when we hold these meetings, we want to make sure that we have representatives there each and every week. So we just want to emphasize those partnerships. And as we meet on a weekly basis, sometimes you have to meet more frequent than that when those issues come up. And so the cooperation amongst all the local agencies here in the Tri-County area has been tremendous. We just want to strengthen that a little bit more.
Anything in particular to say about this person apparently responsible for these sexual assaults, though? I mean, what role would you play there? You're aware of it. Are you pursuing leads in the city of Lansing, for example?
Well, if we have information that we believe that we can be helpful, whether that's with a crime scene investigator, with a detective, with an undercover officer, we'll supply those resources to them. Anytime there's information that maybe a suspect or a witness is in the city of Lansing and they need some assistance, we would certainly help in that manner. So we have been in communication with East Lansing. As soon as they need any assistance here in the city of Lansing, we'll be there to help them.
I want to bring up the case involving Michael Lawrence and get an update on that. Earlier this month, you announced a department-wide policy review after this accused killer, Michael Lawrence, was released from Lansing police custody back in February. Now, a little background here. Last August, Lawrence had been charged with the murder of a 6-year-old girl up in Saginaw, but he came briefly into LPD custody this past February, but he was released. Saginaw authorities maintain he killed again in Saginaw last month, and at last check, I guess Michael Lawrence was still a fugitive. First, what have you learned about department procedures when Michael Lawrence was apprehended by LPD and then briefly held?
Well, this incident obviously is an unfortunate incident that certainly our hearts go out to the family of the victims. What we did learn in reviewing this case is that not only did the police officer, but the detention officers followed all our current protocols and policies that were put into place. But what we believe that we could do is we could strengthen our current policies and procedures, is that if somebody comes into our custody and they're being booked into our processes, that we would fingerprint them for furnishing false information or lying to the police officer about their current information.
And that was what got Michael Lawrence in trouble here in Lansing?
Correct. When he had contact with a police officer, he provided an improper name, a false name. The officer then went down to his patrol car and pulled up computer images. He pulled up our law enforcement network system that had the height and the weight and information that clearly he felt matched the description of the person he had. So the name that he provided the officer tried to verify that through a computer image, and he believed that he had properly identified that particular person as that person.
But the heart of the issue, as I understand it, please correct me if I'm wrong, but the protocol for a false identification is a 90-day misdemeanor, which does not require fingerprinting. So that is part of the reason that Michael Lawrence was not fingerprinted. Is that correct?
Yeah, our policy and procedures mirrored what the state statutes state, that if somebody is arrested for a 93-day misdemeanor or higher, that they need to have fingerprints done and submitted to the state and to the federal level. Since he was brought in as a city ordinance, he was written an appearance ticket. When he was processed, the fingerprint did not trigger an automatic fingerprint of his fingerprints. But what we have changed in that policy is that if somebody is being brought into our facilities and there's any question about the identity of that person, especially for furnishing false information, that they would be fingerprinted to kind of strengthen our current policy and procedure. So to us, it made common sense that if somebody has already lied to a police officer, let's be 100% certain on the identity of that person, even though The state statute says you don't have to fingerprint them. We think it's a good idea that we're going to go ahead and implement that change.
And again, state statute indicates 93-day misdemeanors require a fingerprint, but now you've expanded that to 90-day misdemeanors as well.
We expanded it to anybody that's coming into our facilities or in the into the Lansing Police Department custody, that if we have any doubt on their identity, they will be fingerprinted. And if it's there for furnishing false information, they will be fingerprinted, yes.
You're still investigating? I mean, this guy's got ties to Lansing, apparently. After the August incident, after the April incident, the car of the victim was found here in Lansing, as I understand it. So this guy apparently has ties to the city, correct?
Yes. In mid-April, we were in contact with Saginaw Police Department and assisted them in trying to locate Michael Lawrence here in the city. We've been working closely with Saginaw Police Department and other law enforcement agencies in trying to locate Michael Lawrence. At this time, we have no information that he is currently in the city of Lansing, but again, we are working very closely with Saginaw and other agencies and providing any resources that we can to get him in custody and bring some justice to this case.
And again, getting back to the procedure when Lawrence was taken into custody, has there been any disciplinary action taken against the officers, or did you find that that was not required?
Well, we reviewed the actions of the officers, and we applied to what our policies, procedures, and our protocols, and certainly nobody feels worse more so than the Lansing Police Department and the officer that had contact with him. But this was something that the officer truly felt that he had the proper identification on this person, and he believed that this was actually the person that he had in custody. So when we reviewed all our actions of the officers that were involved, they didn't do anything that was in violation of our policies and procedures. We believe that our policies and procedures just need to be strengthened.
Need to talk a little bit about marijuana. How much legal marijuana do you think is grown in Lansing right now? How much illegal marijuana is grown in Lansing right now?
Well, you know, it's hard to put a figure on that. What we do here at the Lansing Police Department is we focus on our violent crime, and we put our resources to where we believe the most violent offenders are associated with those drug crimes. And when we have these investigations, sometimes they can be done very quickly, and sometimes they take a long period of time to get those investigations completed. But we're gonna dedicate our resources to the most violent offenders that are dealing or using drugs in the city of Lansing. So whether it's marijuana, whether it's heroin, cocaine, meth, amphetamines, we're gonna put our resources to deal with those issues first and foremost.
We have time for just one more question, but I've got to ask you about this. There was a recent incident based in Meridian Township where seven men were found guilty of federal marijuana crimes. Several of the attorneys call it a horrible miscarriage of justice. And a part of this story apparently involves the fact that these guys wanted to grow marijuana legally, and they actually consulted with the police department. Beforehand, they were nonetheless prosecuted. What do you make of the fact that an apparently open, transparent relationship with the police still resulted in sentences? This is an awful, confusing kind of situation. Does anything like this ever come up in Lansing?
Well, over the last several years now with the medical marijuana laws and statutes that have been changed and in court constantly to give us some guidelines, obviously there's still some confusion amongst the law enforcement community as to what's really being enforced and where are the laws and the statutes going to go with medical marijuana. But in Lansing, you know, again, we focus on how does that result in violence and crime, violent crime in the city of Lansing, and that's where we're going to take our resources to and make sure that we enforce those laws that are providing violent crime in the city of Lansing.
But are you aware of anyone ever coming to the police authorities and saying, look, this is what I want to do. Medical marijuana is legal in Michigan. How do I do this? I don't want to break any laws. Have you ever encountered anything?
Well,
like
we've
that?
Had a lot of communication with people in the community asking about the medical marijuana laws and the statutes. And what we do is we just basically state to them what the actual laws and the statutes are. And then they can make that determination whether they want to move forward with a business venture or not.
Michael Yankowski is the new interim police chief in the city of Lansing. Chief, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Mark.
Current state on 90.5 WKAR, Carl Goode is graphics editor-in-residence at MSU's College of Communication, Arts, and Science. Goode's talents also take the form of painting. Now, after more than 20 years since displaying his work in galleries, oils and watercolors by Carl Goode are now on exhibit at MSU Global. In the Nisbet building on campus, current state's Peter Worf met with Carl Goode at the gallery a few days ago, where the two talked about some of his paintings and the creative process. And Peter Worf joins me now. Carl's a guy we all know in this building.
We sure do.
He's a talented guy. Were you surprised to find out he was a good painter, too?
Not really. That guy got on the talent line several times. It's not fair.
What did you see?
Well, I saw about 30 paintings from more than 20 years of his work on canvas and paper. We featured Carl on Current State a couple of months ago with his Put It On Paper exhibit, part of the Put It On Paper exhibit at the Michigan Historical Museum. So I saw 30 paintings just the other day, from the super real to the impressionist style. He's a guy who loves color. And we looked at a few paintings and talked about them and talked about his interesting painting process.
I am pretty crazy about it. Like, I'm crazy about painting. I'm crazy, crazy good, crazy bad. Painting is very alluring. It's sort of like a siren. Come paint, you know?
What gets your painting motor going?
Well, it's never, I shall make a painting today because I need some money. I need to paint, you know, the gallery's bugging me. I got to make some art. I see something that really inspires me or that really gets me charged. It could be a landscape. It could be like these swings. One time I saw these three girls swinging at the end of an alley, and I just felt like I had to paint that because it was like a very compelling image of those girls.
To me, two of your most compelling images are these children playing, the girls swinging, and we'll talk about that in just a moment. Can you tell us about the boys swimming? This is a wonderfully vibrant and moving image. I mean, there's so much movement and life in it.
Yeah, moving literally as in movement. Yeah, it's because it's not emotionally moving. Unless you smile, it's fun. I was at a state park up in upstate New York, and but near enough to New York City to bus some kids from the inner city who don't normally get out of the city to this lake, and they took over the place and had started having a blast in that water and splashing each other around, throwing each other around, and I just love their energy and I love their spirit. And a lot of the people on the beach did not love their spirit and their energy, but I really did. And I went out with my camera and shot a bunch of pictures of kids, just like 50 pictures of them just doing all kinds of things. So this is a compilation of all kinds of things happening together at once. You'll even notice if you look very closely at the painting that two of the kids are the same kid, the kid on the left there and the kid in the center.
You said you took your camera out, and this does look almost like sort of a photographic moment here where you've captured something in high speed with the water droplets of frozen
motion.
Right.
There are two different kinds of paintings that I do and that all artists do. As far back as since the camera was invented, actually the lens, Vermeer used to look through lenses so he could reproduce that blur onto his canvases. And then the camera came along, and you know, it was a great, Eakins, if you know what Eakins is, he's one of the greatest American painters. All of his paintings, from what I understand, you can find the photos he used for his paintings. But, you know, it's just a great way to actually capture the motion and to interpret it into a painting. And when I go outdoors, though, I don't use photos.
A New York State and a New York City image. But here's something very different from New York City. Looks like this is a painting you made maybe from around 23rd Street, looking northeast towards the Empire State Building.
You're very close. It's right outside Barney. It was actually 17th Street, okay. Looking north. But very good. This was done as a wedding gift for a couple who, this was their view out of their apartment, and the husband gave me the keys for 2 weeks. This was actually not done from photos. This was done from me sitting out on the terrace with a big piece of illustration board, 30 by 40, and sketching this and then painting it with watercolor, sitting right there. Yeah. Rain, shine, all the time. And I worked just down the street, so it was easy for me to... Actually, I worked right up there by the Chrysler Building. Right.
This is a watercolor print looking at the Empire State Building, the Chrysler Building, and some of the other buildings, 42nd Street to roughly 17th.
That's right.
And it's a beautiful saturated color
piece. Yeah, most
too.
People don't do watercolors. I'm a very bold artist. I'm a very hyper-realistic artist. Yeah. And I don't get any satisfaction from these washy, wishy-washy wash watercolor things. I feel that they're not finished. And so people ask me who do watercolors, how do I get such saturated colors? And it's because I literally, you know, the little, you know, you've all had them, those little cakes in the watercolor, you know,
yeah.
sets. I just swish the brush around there so much that it just gums up that paint into this almost putty, and I paint like that.
Lots of pigment, not much water mixed in.
Very much, yeah. The only thing that was very washy, and I did it last, was the sky. And I soaked the whole sky in water first, let it soak into the paper, and then I soaked it again, and avoiding the Empire State Building, the other bit, the skyline, and then I washed over that whole thing with blue. That was a very dangerous thing to do at the end of this very time-consuming watercolor.
A few urban images. Can we walk over to sort of a pastoral scene here, which is one of the largest in your exhibit here, of cows in a field. It's gorgeous.
It is. Well, you know, I like painting big. One reason I love painting big is because I felt that if you're standing in front of a painting, you should feel like you're standing right there experiencing this image, and like you're part of the image. It's so big. And so, believe it or not, I used to be a dairy farmer, and I had Holsteins like this. And so I felt I had at least one painting. I actually got a commission by a woman who liked this, and I did it for her. That was years ago. But yeah, so I felt I had one good Holstein painting in me to just do, just to get that Holstein thought out of my head, you know. But plus, I used to farm. I dairy farm these cows. I milk them. I raise them. And I delivered 27 cows. And I felt a need to mark that moment, and also to try to capture the feeling of what it was like to be out in the fields with these cows.
Where might this be happening here?
Vermont.
Oh, this is Vermont.
Yeah, that's where I had my farm.
Very cool. Well, let's go across then to something. You have so many different things, different scenes and ways of composing images. Here's a beach scene, which you described your style as sort of a hyper-realism. These look like they're almost different figures lifted from photos.
They were. This is one of my very first paintings, believe it or not. I did a lot of drawing up until this point. So this painting is 25 years old, and this is just a print of it. I actually sold it because the woman I'm lying with on the towel next to is my ex-fiance, and she looks pretty good there. And so,
is that you next to her?
That was me back when I had dark hair. But you know, I my wife was the one painting. My wife said had to go because that woman was 6 feet. This is a 6-foot by 6-foot paining, and my wife said, I'd really like to not have her looking
laying on the beach next to your ex-girlfriend.
And yeah, and she looks awesome. So get rid of that. And so my wife is awesome. She would never, you know. But yeah, I told all of my, I wanted to learn how to paint. So I told all of my friends, literally most of those were high school friends, send me photos of you at the beach, because we grew up in a beach community, and I'll put you in a painting. And so they all did. And so those are all just from photos. The trick was changing the light on all of them so they looked like they were all getting bathed in the same light from the same direction of the sun.
Yeah. And that sand looks super hot.
I had to paint that sand 3 or 4 different times until it looked like sand. Once it looked like snow, and it looked like mountains, and it was like, when am I going to make this? And same with the clouds. I think I had 3 or 4 different clouds, but I woke up in my 33rd floor apartment in New York one day, and I looked out the window, and those clouds were floating overhead like starships. And I thought, those are the clouds for this painting. And all the little things were done, you know, they were in my apartment, the flip-flops and the cigarettes.
We're speaking with Carl Goode about his exhibit of paintings at MSU Global in the Nisbet Building here at Michigan State University. What's something, we're looking at paintings from the 80s until today. What's something recent?
Well, I just painted this this year. This is two bushes, actually. It looks like one, but it's two, a yellow and a red bush. In my backyard, I see it outside my window every morning. It's different in winter as it is in spring and summer and in fall. And I just love the energy. I always saw movement. And so my theory with this was to capture the movement that I saw in that bush every morning, and this was definitely not done from photos. I, you know, did it right through my window. But it was in fall, obviously, and I just loved this. Believe it or not, this whole painting took less than a day to do, and I was just so into it, you know, and I was, you can see that it's extremely loose and that it's got a lot of energy just in the paint strokes themselves.
Yeah, really, really flickers from color to color, flicker, from texture to texture.
Flicker, that's a great word. Yeah, it because there were flicks of paint. I mean, it was, to me, my most impressionist moment in success, I would say, in my, because I'm a great fan of the impressionists, but I just don't have that gene in me to do what they did. I'm a big fan of Van Gogh, like crazy fan of Van Gogh, but this was the closest I've ever come to actually feeling that I came close to what I imagine I could do someday.
You mentioned Van Gogh, and you can see some of those ideas in Old Langsberg Mill from 2004 with the swirling circular clouds and then the purples and the shadows, that sort of the big brush strokes, maybe even, you know, almost look like put on with a knife.
It is exact. It is 100% inspired by Van Gogh's brushstrokes, and I am nowhere near suggesting that I succeeded in that. But you know, every artist makes it their own. But this was literally done on site in Lanesburg, at the site of this old mill in the back of it, and I had to get it done before the light changed, and so I felt this sun coming through these brilliant clouds, and the grass was just blowing, and so I just tried to capture this feeling with the brush strokes. There's nothing like the sun changing to inspire you to get your ass moving and get the painting done.
Yeah.
And so you have to move quickly. You can't be, you know, obsessing over every brush stroke. So believe it or not, it keeps you loose, it keeps you moving, and it keeps it very impressionistic.
And that purple and the shadows moving across, you can almost see the day going by, the sun moving across, sort of like the cathedral at Rouen or something like that.
Thank you. Yeah. One of my favorite, you know, paintings. All of his Rouen cathedral paintings are great. I definitely wanted to put colors that weren't in front of me. A lot of artists just try to reproduce exactly what's in front of them as with the colors, but I try to add all these crazy colors whenever possible. And so these purples in the wood and the greens in the sky, all of those are to me what I was just feeling at the time.
Carl Goode's work is on display at MSU Global in the Nisbet Building at Michigan State University. Carl, thanks for taking the time today.
Oh, you're welcome, Peter, anytime.
For Current State, this is Peter Wharf.
Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Glad you're along. I'm Mark Bayshore. If you'd like to reach us, we're available via email at currentstate@wkar.org. Yesterday, a public panel in East Lansing may have moved the city a little closer to redeveloping some key downtown space. The city's Park District Review Team made recommendations regarding specific development companies and their plans for that space. Many are eager to get started developing the largely derelict area west of Abbott Road and north of Grand River. And following a public hearing yesterday, the panel recommended that the City Council focus on plans from both DTN Management, based in Lansing Township, and Lurvy White, based in Flint. And joining us to explain in more detail is Community and Economic Development Administrator for the City of East Lansing, Lori Mullins. Hi, Lori.
Hi.
Remind us what part of downtown East Lansing is getting called the Park District these days.
Yes, this is the area that's west of Abbott Road and north of Grand River Avenue. It was previously called City Center 2, as we looked at a project there over the course of several years. And last summer, the city decided to move forward with looking at redevelopment proposals for the properties that are controlled by the DDA and the city, which is about half of what was City Center 2. So it adjoins Abbott Road and goes back to Valley Court Park, and that's why we're calling it the Park District area, is really looking at a larger area there that has a lot of potential for redevelopment, but the RFQP, or Request for Qualifications and Proposals, was specifically for the properties that are controlled by the DDA and the city.
And what's the acreage in the Park District then of the land that we're talking about here?
It's about 2.8 acres.
Okay. And what has the Park District Review Team been doing since February or so? Tell us about that process.
They've held 5 meetings, and they began with reviewing 7 proposals. One of those was withdrawn early in the process. They interviewed 6 different groups that had submitted the other 6 proposals, and they went through a scoring process looking at the different qualifications criteria, which was in the RFQP. Now, the RFQP was developed with a lot of input from our community. We started off by holding some community meetings last fall and coming up with a list of information that needed to be in the proposals, as well as what the community wanted to see in the overall outcome at the end of this process. And so this process that the review committee went through, the 5 meetings, was to look at these proposals in detail and score them based on the criteria and then make a recommendation to City Council.
And tell us about those criteria.
Well, the criteria were divided into 2 categories. There's qualifications based on the ability of the contract of the developers to complete a project of the scale and complexity, their financial capacity, and the like. And then there's different proposal criteria, which looked at really what the development groups were proposing to build there and how that met the needs that were described as the community's needs.
So each of the companies that participated did submit a specific plan for developing the space.
Yes, we did ask for those plans to be very conceptual because there is a requirement that once a development group is selected that they would further define their proposals and come up with something with additional input from the community. So they were conceptual, and we saw a variety of different proposals that had different levels of detail.
So both DTN and Lurvy White are prepared to be a little flexible as we move forward.
Correct.
Okay. What? Tell us a little bit about each of their plans then. Let's start with DTN.
Okay, well, DTN's vision is to redevelop a larger area than what was included in the RFQP. So they're looking at some other sites around the park, as well as the privately held land that's on the corner of Abbott and Grand River.
Bank building.
Exactly, yep. And so they're looking at a larger redevelopment with a multi-phased approach. And they had in their proposal a boutique hotel, housing of various types, unique restaurants, specialty grocer, bake branch, and other commercial and retail space.
And what about Lurvy White?
Lurvy White's vision was to create a Main Street environment off Grand River Avenue, so it would be an extension of Albert Street Albert Avenue. With their philosophy is pulled from Project for Public Spaces. They talked about the Power of 10 rule, which is really a thought that in order for a place to be vibrant and attractive as a destination, it needs to have at least 10 unique and interesting things to do there. And so that was what their vision was really built off from. So they provided a couple of different versions of their plan, which included, the first one included about 315,000 square feet of new development, much smaller than the DTN proposal, but it included housing, including a small number of condos, a hotel, retail space, office space, and about a 20,000 square foot year-round farmer's market.
Tell us more about this Power of 10. What kinds of activities? Do you know what kinds of activities are the kinds that are included in this Power of 10?
Well, what they specifically said in their proposal was, to have the types of different interesting, unique retailers, dining opportunities, the farmer's market piece, but then also things that aren't commercial in nature. So along the streetscape, maybe having some tables with chessboards and some different things like that. So, and to expand upon it, things that weren't in their proposal, it would be a fountain where you can make a wish, or there's you just start adding to it with different things that people make part of their routine when they come downtown that makes it more interesting and more attractive as a destination.
And as this process moves forward, is the idea that either DTN or Lurvy White will get the gig, or is there a chance they could both play a role in what happens down there?
The way it's envisioned right now, one would be selected. So the City Council will go through their own review process. They'll select one developer to move forward with and do a what we call a pre-development agreement. And in that process, then we further define the proposals, get additional community input, and really ensure that the project that is being proposed is feasible and can move forward.
Did you say that DTN's plan did not include the former bank building then? And Lurvy White's did?
No, it's the opposite.
It's the other way around.
Yes,
I beg your pardon.
DTN's does include the former bank building, meaning the former Citizens Bank building. There was also the Fifth Third building there,
right,
which they both include. But DTN's is the larger proposal that includes the Citizens Bank building.
Okay, that's a pretty big piece. What is the status of that right now, of the bank building?
Well, DTN has an option on that building, and we will have to sort of wait and see how that works out, because it's still in a redemption period with the former owners.
How much public involvement here these past couple of months? Would you say the public was pretty involved in this, or less involved than expected, or what?
I would say they were very involved. We did have several members of the community at each of the committee meetings. We also had a group that signed up for updates, and so we've been sending out email updates about the project itself to a number of people, and there's still the opportunity to sign up for those updates if anybody would like to do that. On the website for the project is cityofeastlansing.com/park district, and all of the information about the project is on there, as well as the spot where you sign up for those updates.
And now the ball is in the hands of the city council, correct?
That's correct.
Okay, and what is there some kind of timeline that's attached to this process?
Well, the city council will officially receive the recommendation in June, and they'll hold a work session to discuss that. Then they'll also, or it will be discussed at one of their regular work sessions, and then they'll lay out the process at that time as far as
the
interview schedule and things like that.
And they will just go deeper into feasibility, into design, into financial issues.
Correct.
Everything that's associated with that is taken over by the city council in June.
Yes.
Correct. Okay. Yes. Talk to us about construction in East Lansing.
Yeah.
How long will the orange barrel season last, and how pervasive will it be here the rest of the summer?
Well, right now we have MDOT doing construction throughout Grand River Avenue and Michigan Avenue in our downtown, and they are right on schedule and doing great work. We are seeing improvements to the sidewalks and
you must get a certain amount of flack from the public this time over this.
Of course, it is an inconvenience, but it's something that's going to wind up being a big improvement. And so I just want to encourage everybody to continue to come downtown. It's really not that hard to get past those orange barrels. The streets are open. The businesses are all open. We want to encourage people to continue to come downtown this summer and shop and go to our nice, unique little restaurants and get ice cream and sit in Fountain Square. We've got a lot of great community events coming up.
Sounds good. Lori Mullins is Community and Economic Development Administrator for the City of East Lansing. Thanks, Lori.
Thank you.
Current state on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. The last few years have brought profound changes to the city of Detroit. A financial emergency was declared, and despite opposition from residents and the city council, a financial manager was appointed. Just this month, Mayor Dave Bing announced he would step down from office at the end of his term, and a crowded field of new candidates have announced their intentions. A new book from MSU Press examines the complex history of Detroit, with a focus on race relations around and after the 1967 riots, with some ideas about the city's future as well. MSU professor of geography Joe Darden is the co-author of the book Detroit: Race Riots, Racial Conflicts, and Efforts to Bridge the Racial Divide. Dr. Darden is also the former dean of the MSU Urban Affairs Program, and he joins us now. Joe Darden, nice to meet you.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Go a little bit deeper here as to what the book is about here, beyond what I said.
Okay. This book examines first the causes of the riots of 1967. Some people call them the rebellion. And also, what socioeconomic changes occurred after the riots to improve the residents of the city of Detroit. And then after that, it looks at alternatives for the people of Detroit to improve themselves if they're willing to take advantage of those opportunities.
How would you compare efforts to help Detroit recover after the 67 riots from government, from business people, from residents, to the efforts today to help Detroit recover from its financial and social problems?
Well, let me make it very clear. This book is not a message to the politicians of Detroit. It is a message to the residents of Detroit who wishes to improve their social mobility. After looking at the history of Detroit, going all the way back to 1967, the efforts involving politicians, the state of Michigan, and others, we note in the book that the group that should be the heroes in all of this were the nonprofit organizations that tried every day to improve the city and make it better. They could not, though, match the disinvestment of the investors who were willing to invest outside the city of Detroit and not in the city. As a result of the disinvestment, the city of Detroit continued to decline. Now, we argue that the reason it declined in terms of disinvestment was because investment tends to follow race and class. The investors followed the predominantly white population to move to the suburb rapidly after the riots. The investors went with them and invested there and disinvested in the city. Given that, the residents of Detroit have to make some decisions. What do you do? Do you try and improve the city of Detroit, or do you do this? Do you find out where the high-achieving elementary schools are and public schools in general, and you enroll your kids there, even if it means moving outside of the city of Detroit, or do you stay in the city and try to improve the educational system? After 40 years of effort, we argue in the book that that is not a good alternative. The better alternative is to explore outside of the city, find the high-achieving schools, and move there. That is the best way to improve. If you have a child in the school system, you want to improve their education, that is the best way to do it. And that decision can be made by the parents themselves. They don't need to rely on the mayor, they don't need to rely on city council, and they don't need to rely on the governor. They can make that choice. Now, the second choice they had prior to the emergency manager was they could vote for somebody to represent them. They could vote for a school board, they could vote for the city council, they could vote for the mayor. That choice has been taken away. So the only choice left now is to try and find the best neighborhood to move into, and that would be the best way to improve yourself in terms of education and in terms of access to jobs and other opportunities.
This is you refer to this in your book, I believe, as the spatial mobility option.
That's exactly right.
Do I have that right?
That is correct.
What does that say about the people who do not have the resources to go for those options and are left in the city of Detroit, though?
Well, let me just say this. I think it is a long-held myth that it's cheaper to live in the city of Detroit than to live elsewhere. That is a myth. It is not documented by the evidence. The evidence is that it's very expensive to live in Detroit. And we have documented in the book where you can take the same amount of rent you're paying in the city of Detroit and move elsewhere. And you will then improve in terms of your neighborhood. You'll get access to public schools. You'll get access to better job opportunities just by moving. That is what we've documented in the book. So do not believe that it is cheaper to live in Detroit. Your car insurance, for example, in Detroit will be five times as high just because you live in the city. You need to move, explore your options, and see what they are. However, if you're satisfied with the public school system, if you're satisfied with the taxes you pay, if you're satisfied with the services, then stay there. This is not to say you should move if you're happy. If you're unhappy, you have other options to explore outside of 8 Mile Road. You're not now trapped in there as you were prior to the 1968 Fair Housing Act. You now have those options to move. And that's what we explore in the book, to move outside if you can.
You are debunking a really powerful myth, it sounds to me. There is this Phoenix Rising dimension to Detroit in 2013. The city seems to have, there's been a lot of reporting on the city becoming some kind of magnet for young, idealistic, reform-minded people. In part, I think, because of a reputation for lower rents. But you are saying it actually costs less in dollars to live outside the city.
That's exactly what I'm saying. You see, what you buy with rent is essentially, you rent the neighborhood. You don't just rent the apartment, you rent the neighborhood. And one has to sort of say here, for this amount of rent, what do I get for it? If you compare renting the neighborhood, you get access to better schools because they're public schools. You don't get that in the city of Detroit unless you're willing to pay for a private school. That's the cost. Again, I mentioned before, car insurance. That's a cost. So when it comes to total cost of living in one neighborhood compared to another, you will come out ahead if you explore the option of living outside. I must say again, if you're happy in Detroit, stay there. But you need to explore your options and then make that choice. That's a wise one. And not believe in this mythology that I cannot afford it. This book documents places that you can't afford with no increase in the rent. In fact, some places, well, you can move into with less rent than Japan and the city of Detroit.
I'm envisioning that sign that says, "With the last person out the door, kindly turn out the light." Here, that is, I'm envisioning a very desolate and even more desolate city of Detroit in the future than there is now. If you're advocating this spatial mobility option,
well, here's the thing: cities must compete for their residents. They must offer them something that will make them stay. That may be jobs, good school system, public safety. These are the things that cities must do. You have to compete for your residents. And if you don't offer them those options that they need, they have a right to move. People have always done that throughout history. They always move towards opportunity. That's why they move, either to the job that they want, a high-achieving public school, better neighborhood, public safety. That has been the mobility of people throughout history. Keep in mind, most whites who lived in Detroit at one time left Detroit over time. And nobody said at the time they were leaving, well, what do we do? Who's going to think about the people who left behind? That question didn't come up as much as it does now. However, many people in Detroit at that time also wanted to move. I called it selective suburbanization. In other words, blacks wanted to move, many of them did, but could not. Because of discrimination in housing, they had to stay there. Against their will, by the way, they stayed. Now that the system has opened up somewhat, many of them are moving, in fact. And I'm suggesting that you have to explore your options, make a wise choice, and then decide what you want to do.
And you claim that the racial dynamic is really at the heart of the decline of the city of Detroit.
No question about it. Race is in the forefront. You have two factors here. Race, which drives it, followed by class, because those two operate together. And then the third one is space. Place of residence matter. We cannot underestimate that. And what you've had throughout history is this separation of place of residence by race and class. And that is what perpetuated the whole situation. We call this in the book the demographic imbalance. As long as that demographic imbalance exists between city and suburb, based on race, class, and residential location, this problem is not going to be solved.
What's stopping the race and class dynamic from just moving to the suburbs as well?
Well, here's the thing now. There's still some resistance on the part of some whites who are in the suburb to people from Detroit moving into those suburbs. However, some residents in the city of Detroit may not know that the option exists to move there. They may assume that it costs too much. They may assume that the resistance is going to be so great they don't want to go through it. Or they may assume that if they stay in Detroit and fight, they can improve the situation. We document over 40 years of effort, and they tried hard. That's why I always praise those nonprofits, because they tried to do it, but it did not work. You had the situation with the black mayors. They thought that would be their savior. It didn't work. A black city council didn't work. Those things didn't work because the investors were pulling the strings. They decided whether or not be more investment or not, and they decided that they did not want to continue to invest in Detroit, and they invested elsewhere. That is not uncommon for investors to do that. It is very highly unlikely that investors will invest in neighborhoods that are predominantly black and predominantly poor. That is something that's rare indeed. They often will invest in neighborhoods that are predominantly white and predominantly middle and upper class. That has been the trend, that's the pattern, and I think that pattern will continue.
You do think that pattern will continue? I mean, it's not 1967 anymore.
I think that pattern will continue, yes.
And why do you feel that?
Because, again, race and class still drives investment. Okay. That's why I say that. It still drives it. We haven't gotten over that yet. That still drives it. Now, by changing the demographic imbalance so that race and class do not drive this thing, investors may invest there. But as long as investors see a situation which is overwhelmingly black, overwhelmingly poor, their investment, when they have a choice, will be to invest in those neighborhoods that are predominantly white and predominantly middle and upper class. That is what they do.
We're talking with Dr. Joe Darden. His most recent book is called Detroit, Race Riots, Racial Conflicts, and Efforts to Bridge the Racial Divide. After months and months of anticipation, Detroit's being run by emergency manager Kevin Orr. What impact will the emergency manager situation in Detroit have on what you're talking about here?
Here's the thing. The emergency manager will squeeze whatever resources there are in Detroit. It's already essentially a city that is poor. It will squeeze that even more. That means that either there'll be higher taxes on the people who are there, but the services may not improve. Until anyone can encourage the investors to invest more, to create more jobs in the city, and nothing much will happen. And I argue that given the demographic imbalance, that's not going to happen because they're still competing, by the way, with those places elsewhere. They have a choice of investing in the city of Detroit or investing outside. Most of the investment has occurred outside of the city over that 40-year period.
What do you make of Dan Gilbert's efforts, though? Those are very highly publicized. He's investing big time in downtown.
Well, I think that's fine. Let him do that. But you have to look at it in a comparative context. Is that a small amount compared to those investing outside? I think it is still. Keep in mind, you have to look at it comparatively speaking. Investment is still occurring disproportionately outside. I think it will continue to do that. That has been the trend. That continues to be the case. However, his efforts, I applaud him for that. But I don't think it's going to make a difference sufficiently enough to make people stay there.
MSU professor of geography, former dean of urban affairs programs, Joe Darden is the co-author of the book Detroit, Race Riots, Racial Conflicts, and Efforts to Bridge the Racial Divide. Joe Darden, thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up tomorrow on Current State, Slavery in Film. This year, half a dozen films focusing on slavery are coming out. Why so many? We'll explore that. I'm Mark Bayshore. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR.